Alrighty. Hey, there he is. Okay. This week and next week, and then we're on our break for the month of August, right? So, okay. Last week, we were working in chapter 4 of Ephesians, and we got not quite as much as I wanted to get done, but we got some done. We got up to right around verses 13, 14, in around in there. This week, I want to start right around 14 and work our way through. I have to tell you, now this is just, you know, when you're teaching a book, some parts of the book are naturally lend themselves to being sort of devotional and preachy, you know, and you know, so we're focusing on, those issues that you would have sometimes in a sermon. Other times the book has more to do with history and archaeology and whatnot, and other times you're in a book and it's just tough sledding, even trying to say what are they trying to say in the book, and there ends up being a lot of sort of language stuff, technical stuff, grammatical stuff, whatnot. I have to tell you that as we're moving in chapter 4 here, especially when we hit verse 17, it is really tough sledding in this part of the book to really get a handle on what Paul's trying to say. And so some of what we're going to cover tonight may be a little more language-oriented, technical or whatnot. My goal is never to make this stuff obscure or to make it difficult, but sometimes just, you know, kind of slogging through it, we just have to, there's some grammatical issues that we have to cover. And I think that chapter 4, 17 through, gosh, even through 32, it's tough going, I think. So we're going to start touching on that. So I'm just kind of warning everybody. You know, if we get to it before the break, if we don't start till after the break, you may not want to come back if you don't want to sit through that. You know, so on this stuff. And I have to tell you, I differ significantly in one area with the main commentary that we've been using, with Honer's commentary. I come out on the same end as him. I just disagree as to how I get there. So we'll take a look at some of that. But remember last week we said that the chapter 4 starts the second half of the book. It's the application of what Paul is talking about, and he has this idea of walking, right? So he starts it out by talking about how we need to walk worthy of the calling that we were called to there in verse 1 of chapter 4. You know, Paul has five main sections based around this idea of walking. Most of our Bibles will have that. They'll say, like, you know, chapter 4 here, this part's walking in unity, and you get to, over in 5, you get walking in love and whatnot. There's five main divisions wrapped around this phrase to walk. And remember that walking for Paul means how you live your life, okay? The first one of these sections of walking is in 4:1, where he says we're to walk worthy of the calling that you were called. And some Bibles will have, it'll say walk in unity or something like that, they title it. There's another walking that the second one of these shows up over in 17, where we are to, and in this case, it's a negative reference. You're no longer to walk like the rest of the Gentiles, although he gives the positive end of that. Another one of these walking, the third one of these starts over in 5, with that we're to walk in love in 5:2. The fourth one of these walking comes up in 5:8. We're to walk in the light. We're to walk as children of the light. And then the fifth one of these comes up in the end of 5 over in 15, where we're to walk walk circumspectly. We're to walk not as the unwise. Again, you know, Paul sometimes says the negative, as you know, don't walk as the unwise. So in other words, walk in wisdom. Don't walk as the Gentiles. In other words, walk as a believer, right? But those are the five walking points that we get, the five main ones, and we're circling around those. We're coming out of the unity, walking in unity here, and soon we're going to be walking into this do not walk as the Gentiles. So in other words, walking as a believer. But that's kind of just the big picture how we do this. So anyway, last week we said that in 4:1 he talked about unity, he talked about the one hope, all that, and then we go into verse 7 in chapter 4, which is talking about the gifts, and we're saying that the main idea is in verse 7. But to each one of us, grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gifts. That Christ gives gifts to the church. And we said he validated that in verse 8, and he gave a description of what the gifts were and how that works in 9. And then in 11, starting 11, he started to talk about the distribution of the gifts. And we talked last week about apostles and prophets and evangelists, and I said the key issue on that is to remember that these gifts are not offices or jobs, they're gifts. And or abilities, and there's a difference. You know, we're called, we're all called to be evangelists, in that we're all called to proclaim Christ to the world. Some of us may have the gift of evangelism. You know, those guys that can just immediately walk up to somebody and get onto a spiritual topic, and in 5 minutes they're presenting the gospel. But that's not the job of an evangelist, right? The evangelist, the job evangelist was sort of like, you know, the authors of the Gospels and whatnot. We're talking about the gifts here, separate from the job title. And so we have all these gifts. And we ended last week talking about how we have this really beautiful idea that all these gifts are given to the church. And there's a broad range of gifts, okay? And I think we all, if you've been in a church body longer than a month, you know that there's just a broad range of gifts. And that's one of the incredible things about how God has designed the church and how Christ has measured out these gifts, in that it's multifaceted. It's not all just one gift, you know? I always tell people, you know, it's pretty clear to me that I'm gifted in teaching. And I can take, I think, pretty complex stuff and make it fairly understandable and semi-enjoyable, despite the fact of many of my jokes are very poor. And so that's kind of where I'm gifted. But a whole church of guys gifted like me would be a terrible place to go. If you want to go to a place like that, go to a seminary. And that's not a church. Okay? Just like, you know, you don't want guys who all they do all day long is talk about the use of the enclitic E in the early Samaritan Pentateuch. You don't want that. You want a couple of those guys because you need that stuff. But you don't want everybody to be like that. You got to have folks who come with gifts of the ability of you know, mercy and the ability of pastoral gifts, counseling, you know, more emotion-based, you know, wow, this is incredible, the love of God, this is what it really looks like and how we live. But you don't want a whole church full of those folks either, because then you get way off the end on the emotional spectrum and you don't have any of the grounding of the teaching in. So the thing that God brings to the church is all these different facets. You have all these different gifts. I think that the other thing that's implied by this, and we experience this here in California. In Southern California, we experience this a lot. I know there are some places that don't experience this. We experience not only a range of giftedness, but we experience a range of personalities, of age groups, but we experience cultural mixing here as well. you know, in my church, now my church is my church. I don't own it. The church I go to for years was closely affiliated with Wycliffe. In fact, the Wycliffe headquarters was right in the parking lot of the church I attend. Most of the folks at Wycliffe thought we were the Wycliffe church. We're not. And there's some problems within the politics of church over that. But what it meant was that we had this huge mix of cultural diversity within our particular church body. I have a very good friend of mine, a business associate. We go to the church together. You know, he spent over 5 years living in a remote area of Western Africa, working for Wycliffe, he and the family. His kids were raised up there from the time they were little. Well, he brings back a dimension with his giftedness to our church body that's one that I don't possess. You know, I'm a pretty parochial guy. I mean, I'm a SoCal boy, and you know, I've traveled around, but this is where I grew up. This is the culture I understand. I have other friends that have lived in, you know, Kyrgyzstan, you know, or over in Germany for years, you know, and so they bring all these things. And I think one thing that we get here in California, Southern California, in our churches, that I think is implied here, although not specifically stated, is the giftedness goes beyond just, oh, I teach, I have a gift of mercy, I have the gift of administration or finance, whatever it is. But we have this diversity of cultural understanding. I don't know that you always have that other places, and I don't know that the lack of that is necessarily good or healthy in a church. While my idea of worship on a Sunday morning is not the same as what my friend experienced in, let's say, Kenya for the 5 years he was there, I think it does good for my understanding of worship and practice of worship to include some of the things that were done at a church in Germany or in Kyrgyzstan or in Kenya, because it ends up not just being those same six songs every Sunday and then I, you know, and then I sit down and listen to the sermon. And I think that part of what's going on here is that how God blesses the church is this rich diversity of gifts, and I think as well of culture and of personality. You know, again, you don't want a whole church full of my personality. I'm fun in small doses. You don't want me in large groups. And I also don't want the real serious guy. I don't want a whole church full of real serious guys, but we need real serious guys occasionally. And I don't want a whole church full of that sort of perfect mom, you know, the lady that just you run to for, you know, because she always brings the best pies to the bake sale, and she's the one that you just want to sit and go, oh man, my kids, and she, oh, I had kids, you know, that's great. I don't want a whole church full of her, okay? So this diversity, and I think that's what's going on here. And it implied in a lot of this stuff that we're seeing here in verses 11 and following. Now, the key thing on this was where we ended last time in verse 13. The whole purpose of all this, for edifying the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith. Notice that here he's replicating this idea of unity that we brought into the beginning of the chapter. So the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature to the fullness of Christ. This is, again, the corporate idea. The whole purpose of this diversity of gifts and of cultural backgrounds and personality and everything is not just for the sake of having a whole lot of different stuff, but it's for the purpose of bringing to this idea of the perfect man, the fullness of Christ. It is this mature, unified body, and that's our goal, is to have a mature, unified body. It's a corporate view. Now, we're going to find out why that's important. Why is this maturity important? And I said that this idea, this word here in the Greek, italion, in verse 4:13, has the idea of completeness or maturity. And that's what's going on here. That's what these gifts are for. Now, why is this important? Okay, it's important starting in verse 14, chapter 4, verse 14, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. So the reason that we have these gifts is to bring us to this complete or perfect measure of fullness in Christ, so that, now there's discussion here, starting in verse 14, of whether this is, it starts with that Greek word henna, which always tells us that it means purpose or result or something like that. Henna usually means purpose. And in this case, whether it means purpose or result, I think overlaps. It could be that we have all this giftedness to lead us to this mature unity for the purpose that we should no longer have this tossing to and fro, or for the result that we will not be tossed to and fro. Those overlap. I don't think it's enough to camp on. I suppose when you write commentaries and lecture for a living, you camp on one of them because it just fills the page better. But I think it overlaps.
Could it also be because the goal is for us not to be deceived?
Right, and that's whether it's the purpose is that we're not, or the result is that we're not deceived. Mm-hmm. I think it overlaps, but that's clearly it. Now, what Paul does here is, again, he runs a parallelism. Verse 14 is the negative. Verse 15 is the positive. In verse 14, he talks about this bad doctrine, trickery, a cunning craftiness, deceitful plotting. In verse 15, he gives us the positive side. This mature fullness in Christ should produce speaking truth in love, growing up in all things into him who's the head of Christ. So here's the positive side. The positive side is that we speak the truth in love. The negative side is that we're protected from the stuff that could harm us. Now, it's interesting here. There's a word here in verse 14 said that we should no longer be children. This word, napioi, okay, is a word for child or infant. There's the two main words that we're usually used to in Greek for children is pation and thank you. Technon. And those are the two words that are normally used for children. And sometimes they're interchangeable. Sometimes they have specific meaning. If you go over to John, okay, and people in leadership roles or teachers shouldn't show weakness or lack of knowledge, but I'm gonna exhibit that here in a moment. I'll go to 1 John.
1 John.
Okay. And I used to tell, when I taught beginning Greek at Schaefer, the 5 or 6 years I taught there, I used to tell the students that if you could adequately explain to me 1 John 2, 12 through 14, I would give you an A. And it was interesting because some of them, one, thought I was serious, but no, I was. They would sort of spend time with this. This is a passage that I don't get, okay? But it's actually an interesting passage because John, in the middle of this, changes the words for children, okay? I write to you, little children, because your sins are forgiven you for his name's sake. I write to you, fathers, because you have known him who is from the beginning. I write to you, young men, because you have overcome the wicked one. I write to you, little children, because you have known the Father. I have written to you, fathers, because you have known him who is from the beginning. I have written to you, young men, because you are strong in the word and God abides in you, and you have overcome the wicked one. Okay, here's what I don't get about this. Couple of things I don't get. Number one, the order that he talks to people doesn't make sense. Normally, in almost all languages, when you're giving something in sequential order, you go largest to smallest or smallest to largest, right? Or you go oldest to youngest or youngest to oldest, or first to last, last to first. You can go interchangeably, but you go in order. Well, first of all, he goes children, fathers, young men. That's out of order.
Yes.
Okay, it's a strange order. I don't get that. I don't understand why he does that. Now, here's my point, why we even got to this. He changes the word for children midway. Notice that this is two sets of three. Children, fathers, young men. Then he repeats, children, fathers, young men. So he's got two sets of three.
Correct.
The second time he does it, he changes the word for children. The first time, the word for children is technia. Okay? The second time, the word for children is paideia. Okay? Those are the two words that are most commonly used in Greek for young kids. Point being over here is that in Hebrew, this is a completely different word. In Hebrew, he's using napioi. Okay? Napioi. In Ephesians, he uses a third word for kids. Just to finish my sidetrack here on why I don't get to 1 John 2:12-14, the order seems strange to me. He changes the noun for children for no apparent reason. The third thing he does is he changes the tense of the verb. Now, depending on whether you're reading in the majority text or in the critical text, in your Greek text, he changes the tense of the verb either equally, so the first three are one verb, the second three is a different tense, or in the majority text, he actually does the first three and the first one of the second set with one verb tense, then the last two with another verb tense. So he says, I am writing to you, grapho, okay, in the first set, and then all of a sudden he changes to a agrapsa, I have written. So he changes verb tense in the middle of this. So he has a strange order, he changes his vocabulary, and he changes the verb tense. And I don't get why he does that. And I've been staring at this passage for a long time, and I don't get why he does that. If any of you figure that out, I'll give you my email. Now, I should tell you that there are all kinds of solutions for this that I've heard, from commentaries that I've read that I just went, ah, that's ridiculous, to really good, godly men who were my teachers who have their version of why this works, and I still don't agree with theirs. Okay, so... Well, there's a lot of it has to do, the order has to do with, well, who he's addressing, and that the change is really, the change in vocabulary is arbitrary, it really doesn't matter, he's just changing it up for the sake of using a different word, you know, female instead of woman, you know, the kind of interchanging that we do in English. The verb really doesn't matter. It's just he's putting more emphasis on the I'm writing to you and I've written to you is just the same way of saying the same thing. Anyway, I don't get any of that. It doesn't matter. They also have ages here of that, you know, the babies are brand new Christians, the fathers are old veteran, you know, Christians, and the young men are the sort of middle type. Well, that doesn't work for the wife. The order seems to be out of smallest to largest to youngest to old. A whole bunch of stuff I don't get. But anyway, my whole point of that wasn't necessarily to show you that there are parts of the Bible I don't get. Heck, there's more than just this one passage. But it's to show you that those are the most common words that used for children. All of a sudden, Paul over here in verse 14 uses this napioi. Now, Honer does a good job in the commentary talking about this. A napioi can mean child. Can mean little kid, but it can also mean something like a childish way of understanding things, an immature mind. That word can mean that as well. Well, if we look at that here, that sort of makes sense, because it says that we should no longer be childish in our way of thinking. We should no longer be immature in our understanding. Well, that makes sense here. Rather than that we shouldn't be children, right? And I suppose you could think that it means baby Christian, right? We use that term, right? Baby Christians, somebody that's just brand new. Paul has the milk and meat thing, right? It could be that, but I think that it really is shading towards that idea of what Paul is trying to say here, is that this giftedness, so that we can all be built into this one mature man, is so that we won't have an immature mindset. That we would no longer be childish in our thinking. Because look what's followed. Then he says, he's got these three prepositions, in, and with, or through, depending on how you want to, probably with. So that we would we wouldn't have this immature way of thinking, so that we would be tossed as by waves, being carried about by every wind of teaching. Well, now I think that's a wonderful word picture of what happens. If you've ever, right now, in my personal life, I'm really working hard to make sure that my wife and I are really being nutritionally sound. We're really working to eat healthy, right? The minute you try to start finding out, I know you guys have all done this, you find out, well, what's healthy? What's the healthy way? What should I eat? You know, should I have a steak or chicken or fish or veg, you know? Well, there is so much stuff out there that this idea of being tossed to and fro by the wind, being tossed around on the waves, that's what it's like, right? You try to read a scientific, you know, let's say you're having heart problems, and so you go out to read the science of, well, one guy says, well, yeah, you should eat red meat and smoke because that'll make your heart bend. The other guy says, no, you should eat brown rice and tofu because that's, you know, there's just stuff all over the place. Well, we get that theologically, right? We get, you know, within my own sort of area of theology, within the free grace camp. My friend just on his blog just referred to it as the food fight that's currently going on in free grace theology. And then you expand that out and say, well, then you've got the lordship theology, and then you've got dispensationalism versus covenant theology, and you've got, you know, bam, this stuff's just flying around. Well, what Paul is saying here is that our goal, because of all the gifts to the church, to this one unified, mature body that we should be going to, is to stop us from being, you know, running willy-nilly after the next guy who just happens to be a dynamic public speaker. Oh, I agree with everything he says. And then you go home and you read a book by a different author and you go, oh, well, I agree with everything he says. And, you know, and to stop this idea of being to and fro. But he extends it out now, outside of just within the church, crazy theology, but now to these three prepositional phrases, by the trickery of men. And by the way, the preposition there is en, which is normally in, but in this case, it's we can translate it by, as opposed to in. So by the trickery of men, by and now an extension of that, by the craftiness. That they have. So the trickery, and now Paul's taking, again, the stair-step manner, the trickery of men, the craftiness of what they're saying, their deceitful scheming, their deceptions. So now Paul says that part of this maturity that we're moving to is that we won't fall prey to the trickery of men, to their craftiness, to their deceitful schemes. You know, it is... I have some good friends that go to... the LDS Church, okay, the Mormons. You know, and particularly, I have a good friend who's one of the smartest guys I know. I mean, this guy is 10 times smarter than me. He is frequently more godly in his action than I am, in terms of a father and a husband and a man within his community. And he is just an awesome guy, but he's LDS. And what's amazing to me is what to me seems ridiculous in terms of some of the theological positions, not even addressing some of the ridiculous archaeology that you have to do to get there, he is firmly convinced of. And I often think that here's an example of giving, you're falling prey to these crafty, deceitful, cunning strategies. And it's not like the folks who, you know, McConkie, who's one of the big theologians of the Mormon Church. McConkie's book, Doctrine of the Mormon Church, is one of the classic things for understanding Mormon doctrine. You know, you read, McConkie was not, you know, a shabby used car salesman. He was a decent guy. You know, by social standards, he was a very good man. He was the kind of guy I'd want living next door to me, you know. A good man. And he sincerely believed, you know, what he was doing. But what happened was, I think you could get guys like that, you know, Satan loves to see a false gospel out there. And he loves to see a false gospel out there in a way that's very attractive and understandable. And so, you know, he works behind to get this stuff out there. So some of these crafty, deceitful schemes on the surface don't look like they're bad. It doesn't look like they're selling you snake oil. But in reality, they are, because it's a false gospel. And so sometimes the sincerity or the intelligence of the people presenting these doesn't show us the evil behind it. And again, the way we overcome this, the way I talk to the Jehovah's Witnesses when they come to my door, is to say, well, I'm not going to be, they can give me their pamphlet, probably already read it, I'm not going to be swayed by that, because I've got this grounding, this mature body that we're talking about keeps us from being swayed by all these doctrinal things, by the latest stuff that we see on TV or that we hear on the radio or something. So this whole idea of this not having an immature mind, this childish way of thinking, that I think Paul is using that term for children there, or infants, is that we would stop this sort of thing. Now, on the positive side, it's summed up very easily. The positive side, but speaking the truth in love. That's it. Speaking the truth in love. Notice in love, remember that I said this is a corporate book. The in love has to be all of us. This is talking about the unified body of Christ. Remember back over in 1:4, chapter 1, verse 4, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before him in love. Remember I said that was important, that in love meant how we all are together as a body? That's what this is talking about here. It's not individual theory. It's not my own take on theology. It's when I speak the truth in love. Yes, it's the kind of thing that we're talking about over in 4:2, where we're talking about humility, meekness, and patience. Certainly that's what it means. But it's the truth coming out of this unified body of Christ. It's the truth in love. It's, again, this corporate idea here. I just think that kind of, these ideas are so important. We find that in love again at the very end of this section, in verse 16. From whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working of each part, can cause growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Again, it's this idea of we stand holy, and the whole purpose of what God has done is so that we would stand together in front of him as a body, holy and blameless in love. We need to speak the truth in love. The whole metaphor of the body growing up together, causing growth, edifying itself in love. That concept of this corporate idea of giftedness for maturity and as protection against a wrong and deceitful and evil theology, and the building up of each other in love, is all tied to that huge plan of why God did what he did, why the church is there, why that body of Christ is there in love, holy and blameless in his sight in love. So I think that ties in there. It's very important to see how that ties in. There's another point was brought up actually in Honer's commentary in verse 16 about this this word joint, from whom the whole body joined and knit together by what every joint supplies. Now, sometimes it's, well, what's the joints? Okay? And is it the apostles? Is it the prophets? Is it this stuff? In the modern church, are the joints, you know, we're all like the bones and the muscles and the tendons, and the joints are like the pastors, or, you know, the deacons or the elders or whatever. And I agree with Honer on this point. That's not at all what he's saying there. That word joint, Honer makes an excellent argument that it should be translated as contact. Okay, that it's where these things meet.
Connections.
A lot of times when we talk about the human body, we sort of make these sort of general statements. We make these sort of analogies. We make metaphors. We talk about I want strong muscles, or if I stretch, I want to stretch my tendons and ligaments. Right. We talk about a healthy body as we've got strong bones, right? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that one thing, right? Yeah, you know. Sometimes strong bones means is a metaphor for more than just bones, right? Your muscles, your organs, you know, your tissue, your hair and everything. Right. This idea of the joints is this connection, this point of contact. And I'll tell you how this stuff works, this giftedness works. And I see it in my church that I go to every Sunday, and the folks that I talk to in my church all the time. I see what this means. This contact, this connection means that where this giftedness works, where this building up of the body, where this maturity comes from, is the connection where people bump into each other, okay? I've had a situation in my home church where for a number of years now, I've sort of made myself very available to some of the younger guys in the church as they're learning theology and kind of getting through stuff, okay? Not that they're baby Christians. I mean, these are just guys in their 30s, you know, who are working through stuff, right? And I have tried to make myself completely available because that's what I think I'm called to do. God's given me access to a lot of information. I should make it available to anybody that, right? So I spend time on the phone and on the internet, email, and after church, and, you know, in the evenings I'll get a call, right? And I've done that for a number of years. Now, some of these guys have things that they do, that they bring to our church body, that now I'm starting to benefit. Things that they do, services they provide, ministries within the church that my family benefits from. And I remember I was talking to this one guy. I love this guy. He's an incredible guy. And I was talking to him one day, and I said, I can't begin to tell you, you know, how much my family is thankful to you for the ministry that he and his wife have in our church and how my family's benefited from that in huge ways. And I said, I just wish there was some way I could adequately thank you for the impact you and your wife have made on my family. And he just started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? He goes, why would you want to thank me or pay me back for this? He said, haven't I called you, you know, 3-4 times a week and emailed you and talked to you for years about obscure points of theology? And he said, you've always been there. And he goes, that's made me grow as a person so much. Why wouldn't you expect to benefit from what my ministry brings? And it was so clear, and he pointed out the Ephesians model. This is where this growth takes place. It's these points of contact. It's not that the pastor's the elbow joint and we happen to be a forearm and somebody else is a bicep muscle. It's the joint is these places of contact. It's where we sit with a brother or a sister who's struggling with something. It's where we go visit somebody in the hospital. It's where we answer a phone call when somebody has a theological question. It's where we bring a meal to somebody that just had a baby and you know, her husband's working and she needs food. You know, that's this stuff. That's what he's talking about here. That's the application of all this joint and muscle stuff that he's talking about. And the goal of that then is that we all end up being this one edified body, this one mature body in Christ in love. That's the whole point of all of this. So it goes from being a theological concept to being a real actual, it's where the rubber meets the road. It's where we're sitting with each other on Sunday or Wednesday nights or on Tuesday afternoons or whenever we do this stuff. And it's not just the I'm praying for you kind of Christianity, which is important. Please, feel free to pray for me constantly whenever you want to. But it's the real, can I feed you? Can I babysit your kid? Can I give you a ride to the doctor? Can I answer your theological question? Can I see you getting into trouble and get you out of it before you go down the road you shouldn't? You know, these are the things that's what this passage means in the real life in a church, okay? Okay, so that gets us up to now this next section, this second walk section here, starting in 17. And this really, this chapter 4 I take for... really, verse 17 all the way through to 32, I think, is one big block. You can divide it up probably 17 through 24 and then 25 through 32, but it is one big chunk here. And so let's go ahead and take our break now, and then we'll start looking at 17, because this is some tough stuff that we're going to need to wade through here. So we should have a good break to get ready for it. Okay, so now, moving into verse 17. Let me read through. Overall, kind of what happens here is that 17 through 32, you again have this parallelism. Remember in 15 and 16, we had the negative-positive parallelism, right? Same thing occurs here. 17, 18, 19 is the negative. And then 20 through 32 is really all the positive stuff. Although there is a break here in 25 but anyway, it's the sort of the application of 17 through 24. But let me just read 17 through 24 because that's what I want to spend a little time on now. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanliness and greediness. Can you tell that Paul's not crazy about these folks? But you have not so learned Christ. If indeed you've heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. We'll stop there. I won't go to the therefore, because then I'll have to tell you what it's there for. There we go. I hate it when people say that, by the way. When you see therefore, stop to see what it's there for. That's a sermon crutch. It preaches really well, but it's a terrible thing to say. So here's this passage now, this that we are to not walk as the Gentiles. And he paints this really negative picture of what walking like a Gentile means. Overall, what's going on here? What's behind this, what Paul's trying to say, is that, you know, 1 through 3, Paul told us the incredible stuff that God's done, okay, right? He chose us, he predestined us to our inheritance, to be adopted as children. Christ came and redeemed us through his blood. The Holy Spirit seals us and is the down payment of the promise of our spiritual blessing and our inheritance. And all this stuff, Jesus is reconciled at the cross, a Jew and Gentile together in one new man, and now that new man, that new body is fully reconciled to God. And Christ gifted us with, surrounded by other believers who are gifted and talented, and we have talents and gifts, and all of us work together in this wonderful body to be holy and to be blameless and in love each other, to be presented to God as His trophy. All of that incredible stuff. And now Paul says, why? If he's done all of that, why would you go ahead and walk around and live your life like all these people who haven't experienced that, right? I mean, think about it. All of us have been taken from the place where we were, as Ephesians 2:12 says, we were in the world without God, without hope. That's where all of us were. We've now been fully reconciled to God. We are now God's children. Literally, where God adopted us as children. Why then would we go out and walk like the Gentiles? Why would we want to go back? No, Lord, I don't want to be adopted as your child. Please, I would prefer to be in the world without hope and without you. I mean, that's an absurd thing, right? But yet, remember, this is the application section of Ephesians. This is the practical application of that. In reality, when we don't live in unity with our giftedness, you know, in unity with other believers, when we're out there mucking about with all our own selfish interests, we're walking like the Gentiles. We are saying, no, you know what? I would prefer to be in the world without hope and without God. Thank you. That's what I like. I want to align myself with those people. So that's what Paul's going to talk about here. Now, again, I said he does it negatively and then positively. This passage, verse 17, starts with this word, therefore. In the Greek, it's the word un. Some of your translations, like the New King James, has this I say, therefore. So they bury the therefore. Some translations put it further forward. But most of the time, when you see that word un, it's pointing back to something. Okay? a lot of times we can say, in light of this, you know, that I just said, now this, okay?
Well,
so, right. Now, there's some discussion as to how far back this therefore points, this word un.
Is it post-positive, by the way?
It is in this situation, yeah. I think un is post-positive every time. Yeah. Post-positive, for those of you not fluent in Greek grammar, as other members of our class are, just means that it always comes as a second word in a sentence. In English, we don't do that. In English, are connecting words, but and it always comes first. But in Greek, it's always second. The word de is the most common in Greek, and it always comes second. It's post-positive. It's just a gar. Yeah, gar is that way too. In un is doing that here. They just seem to shove these to be the second word. I don't know why. That's just how Greek. Well, there's a reason for it. All languages have reasons why they do things. I just don't happen to know right off the top of my head why these particular words do that. But they always do that. So, what is this pointing back to? What's the therefore? Is it therefore that this passage we just got done about the giftedness? Is it therefore that we're a unified body in love? Arguments can be made for any of these. But since I'm teaching the class, I'll tell you the one I think. I think it points all the way back to 4:1. See, I think in 4:1, Paul gave us one of those great sort of thesis statements. In 4:1, he says, "I urge you, therefore, the prisoner in the Lord, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called." Now, he goes on to talk about what that looks like. He talks about the unity. He talks about the giftedness. But I think that when he brings this word walk up again, that we're not to walk like the Gentiles, I think he's pointing back to that. He's saying that we should walk worthy of the calling that we were called. We should not walk like the Gentiles. So I take that un, that therefore, in verse 17 and say, I think he's pointing back to what he said in 4:1. There's arguments to be made that he used a lot of other points in 4, but I think that's the main one. Okay, so he says this, therefore I say to walk, and then he has this this walk. Remember, live, translate the word walk as to live your life, as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind. Now, again, I don't think Paul makes laundry lists. I think Paul makes stair-step statements. So this description of what's going on in the walking like a Gentile, how the Gentiles walk, is, I think, a stair step. It's compounding. He's just giving you more and more detail of the same thing. Right. And now there's a lot of stuff written about in the grammar here. There's a couple of participles. There's three participles, sort of right side by each here, and how we're to understand those. Again, this is part of the grammar here. You know, participles are, they're part verb and they're part noun, okay? So they're on, you know, all language is divided into noun stuff, verb stuff, and odds and ends, like connectors and prepositions and all that, okay? And participles and infinitives have one foot on the noun side and one foot on the verb side. A participle is a verbal adjective, okay? And those of you who sat in my Greek class love this, my wonderful choreographed explanation of a participle. Sometimes they're verbal adjectives, and sometimes they're verbal adjectives, okay? So they're, sometimes the emphasis is more on one side than the other. If I say, my brother-in-law is a farmer, okay? My wife's oldest sister, her husband. And if I go up to his property, I'm up there in Ventura County, and I say, "Boy, this is farming country." Well, there the participle farming is being used as an adjective to describe the kind of, this is farming country up here. But if I say that my brother-in-law is going to school while farming, then it's being used more like a verb, right? Because you see the difference there? So it's the same word, farming, it's the same sort of participle, but it's some the emphasis is more on the adjective side, sometimes more on the verbal side. Well, depending on how you take these participles here that are all strung together, having been darkened, being estranged, these things, is to how you understand this sort of connection of these things. I believe that Paul is doing it in a stair-step manner, and he's expanding on just how bad the Gentiles are living. Okay? In the futility of their mind. Well, what does that mean? Well, their understanding is darkened, right? The futility of their mind. They're doesn't make sense. They're not thinking correctly. Doesn't mean that they're thinking impaired, but it means that their thinking is futile. Do you see the difference there? We say that a person who has a genetic or a birth defect that doesn't allow them to their brain doesn't function the way a normal brain would, whether it was, you know, deprived of oxygen at birth or a birth defect or something in the brain, we say that their thinking is impaired, right? Even those of us who have functional brains, if we have one too many glasses of champagne to celebrate New Year's, our thinking becomes impaired, right? Or medication that we take for a cold or whatnot. So he's not talking about impaired thinking. He's talking about the futility of their mind. In other words, their thinking is that cunning and deceitful stuff that he was talking about back and forth. It's that they don't think clearly and correctly, okay?
Is it because he's comparing it to, in terms of the gospel, the spiritual?
I think he's talking about just in general, just how they approach life. Specifically, it's the gospel, and they do not understand the truth of God. You'll see in a second here, I think this is all tied to what he talked about in Romans. I think this is strongly tied to what he talks about in Romans. Because the futility of their mind comes from their understanding is darkened. They just don't get it. Their understanding, they don't put two and two together. They're alienated from the life of God. This causes them to be, they don't want to follow God, right? They want to follow their own path. Remember over in 2, what he said that when we were in sin, we were dead in our trespasses and sin. What did we do? We walked in this age according to the ruler of of this age, like the sons of disobedience. We conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh. That's what he's talking about here. Okay, so they have futile thought patterns because their mind, their understanding is darkened. They're estranged from the life of God. They are alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them, because of the blindness of their heart. Remember Paul prayed that the eyes of their heart would be opened, the Ephesian believers, to understand their inheritance? Well, here, he's contrasting. Here, the eyes of the Gentiles' heart are blind. This is exactly, I think, what's going on. Go over to Romans. Romans 1. In theology, we talk about revelation in two things. We talk about general revelation and special revelation. Okay, special revelation is the Bible. It's the gospel message that Jesus' death on the cross was the propitiation for our sins. That's special revelation. You have to get special revelation from a source. God has to give you that in the scriptures, through a prophet, through an apostle. General revelation is what we know about God just in general. It's open to anybody. Anybody knows that. You don't have to read the Bible to know general revelation. Okay? General revelation is sufficient to tell you about God and to condemn you. It is not sufficient to teach you how to be saved. You need special revelation for that. That's in theology, classic theology, that's what you learn the difference. Well, Romans 1 talks about general revelation. Paul says, verse 18, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness." Well, that's what the Gentiles are doing, the futility of their mind, right? And why is the wrath of God? Verse 19, chapter 1, Romans, "Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them." Verse 20, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." That's general revelation. You can know God from His creation. You don't know how to be saved, but you can know God. It is amazing to me that a scientist can be an atheist. because you look at, I was just watching a program on TV last night that was incredible, talking about how plants, how humans take in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide, and trees gather in carbon dioxide and then breathe out oxygen. And it's this incredible process. And I just, that's unbelievable. I mean, that's just wonderful. Well, the guy talking about it didn't say, isn't this amazing how God set this up? The guy talking about it was looking at it purely from a science standpoint, because he wanted to create something that could suck in CO2 and pump out oxygen, just like trees do. So he was trying to mimic a tree. How do I build a tree, essentially, is what this guy was doing. And throughout this, I'm thinking, wow, that's incredible how God did this, right? Well, that's the general revelation thing. You know, you see the sunset on the beach. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be up in the Eastern Sierras, and I'm just overwhelmed by God. I mean, to me, it would be impossible not to see God when you're standing up 10,000 feet in the middle of the Sierras. It's just God is just there. So he's talking about, he's saying, look, this is out here, okay? That God can be known, his eternal power and Godhead. And again, Romans 1, verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him, nor were they thankful. In their foolishness, their hearts were darkened, okay? Verse 22, professing to be wise, they became fools. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, birds, four-legged animal. They've changed over from being wowed and worshiping God that they see in nature to now changing over, creating their own idols in their own likeness of things that are corruptible and finite. This is the state of man. This is what he's talking about here in Romans. And he goes on, you know, on and on in this passage to talk about how, therefore, he said, all right, fine, you want it your way. He gave them up to their uncleanliness, the lust of their hearts, the dishonor in their bodies, exchanged the truth of God for a lie, worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator, gave them up to vile passions. It talks about that they end up becoming Episcopals, actually. If you've been following the news lately, the Episcopal Church just voted that they were now going to not only say that it was okay to have gay marriage, and they would have special, but they were going to go to the trouble to write special ceremonies just so they could have gay marriages, and they have these special ceremonies that they were going to write. So apparently, we see in the Episcopal Church the outworking of what Paul is clearly talking about here in Romans 1. So he gave them up to be Episcopalian. Anyway, that's what he's talking about here, okay? That's what this is. That's what's happening to the Gentiles. That's these series of participles, this sort of descent from just not getting God to this descent into being past feeling, given over to lewdness, to work all uncleanliness and greediness. That's walking like Gentiles. And Paul is saying, we don't walk that way, okay? That's not how we live. The reason why is that we're on the opposite. We get who God is. In fact, not only do we get who God is in the general revelation sense, the Romans 1 sense, we get who God is through special revelation. Paul, that's the mystery of the church, right? So we get this. Because we get that, we're not to walk like these Gentiles. We don't have futility of thought, right? That's what he just said earlier in chapter 4. All this giftedness and building up creates a mature believer that's not thinking futile thoughts, is not given over to this. So the verse 17 and 18 and 19 give us the negative. Now, verse 20 starts the positive. So in verse 20, but you've not so learned Christ, if indeed you've heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct. Okay, so we've got the whole old man, new man thing. Okay, this is where it gets really tough. This is one of those things that on the surface you read and go, no, I get that. But then when you start really delving into it, you go, whoa, wait a minute, there's some stuff here I may not get. One of the first things that happened is that, remember back in chapter 3, I talked about a first-class condition, a conditional phrase. Remember, if I say, you know, if I flick the light switch, then the lights will turn on, right? There's a conditional phrase has two parts. A protasis and a apodosis. This is formal, you know, grammar, logical sort of language. The protasis is the if part. The apodosis is the then part, right? Computer language is filled with conditional things, right? If you know cell B3 is 1, then cell C4 will be 0. You know, just that kind of stuff, right?
If then
is a conditional phrase, right? Well, Paul has an if-then statement here in the exact same way he had the if-then statement back over in verse 3. If you go to chapter 3, just to refresh your memory, he starts out chapter 3 in verse 2, he says, "If indeed you have heard of the stewardship of the grace of God being given to me for you." And I remember I said in the Greek, we could tell that was a conditional statement because he says, "Ege," right there, right? That's that's the protasis. That's the if part of the statement. And then I said that the then part of the statement, you had to go all the way over to verse 13 in chapter 3, where he says, "Therefore," so if you know about this, then, that's the then part, the apodosis over there in 13, and he uses the Greek word dia there to introduce that. Okay, back in chapter 4, verse 21, you've got the if part, the protasis, ege, the exact same way they started it in chapter 3. The problem here is the apodosis came before it. Okay, so in this case, Paul puts the then before the if. So that makes this kind of hard to follow his logic. I don't exactly know why Paul put the then before the if, because most of the time we say, if you do this, then this will happen. What Paul is saying is, then this will happen, and then he's saying, if you do this. But not in the way that in English that really creates this same condition. He changes it around here. So that's the first problem with this. The second kind of thing that's weird about this is what he's saying, Paul is saying something, he's saying something positive, but Paul uses a particular grammatical or figure of speech here. By saying what he wants to say positive, he's saying it negatively. You've not learned Christ. You've not learned Christ like this. Well, what Paul is saying there is, you have learned Christ like this, but he says it in the negative. But you have not so learned Christ. The term there is that's a litatis is the figure of speech there, where you say something in the negative and you mean the positive. Okay. But yeah, but
that's no small problem.
Yeah,
we got.
Yeah, yeah.
It means it's a big.
It's a huge problem. But Paul is doing the apodosis, the then part, before the protasis, before the if part, and he's saying the then part, he says it negatively, but he really means the positive. You see? Okay, so that makes it a little tougher. The other thing is that he's got three infinitives here. To put off, to be renewed, and to put on. So verse 22, to put off your former way of life, the old man. Verse 23, to be renewed. And then verse 24, and to put on the new man. Now, this is a situation where we got to figure out, are these commands? You put off. You be renewed. You put on. Or is he just making statements of fact? Okay, as believers, you've put off, you've been renewed, and you put on. Okay, how do we take that? Is it a command, or is it just a statement of fact? Part of the trouble here that makes this even muddier is this is sort of in what we call indirect discourse. Direct discourse is where I say, and I told the guy, blah, or, and I'm telling you, blah, 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 right? That's direct discourse. Indirect discourse says, oh, 3 days ago I was having a conversation with a guy and I told him blah, blah, blah. That's indirect discourse. I'm relating to you in the present about something that was said in the past. Well, here Paul is talking about stuff that occurred in the past, but he's talking about it in the present. So how do we take a command that's in indirect discourse, or how do we take a statement of fact that's in indirect discourse? And these three infinitives here. Now, why does this matter? Well, if it's a command, we have to obey it. Right? Because the way we understand the Bible is those things that are specifically commanded, we do. Those things that are specifically prohibited, we don't do. And everything else, we have freedom as believers to choose where we go. Right? So if this is a command, I need to make sure that I specifically follow it. If it's just a statement of fact, this is just what happens when I'm a believer, then I don't have a new command. I don't have to do this thing. Right? You tracking with me here? Okay. So, how do we do this? Well, first of all, it would be easy if these were verbs that were imperatives, because we know a verb that's the imperative means it's a command, right? And Paul has a lot of those, and we know they're commands. They're not. I used to always like it when people would preach and they say, "Now, Paul's not making a suggestion there; he's commanding you." Okay, but in this case, they're not. They're infinitives. Remember, I said participles are verbal adjectives, so they're half verb, half adjective. Well, a infinitive is a verbal noun. Okay, it's part verb, part noun. There's two different ways we can take an infinitive in indirect discourse. If I come home tonight and I go in and the dishes aren't done and I grab my daughter and I say, "I told you to do the dishes," what am I doing? I'm using an infinitive to do the dishes in my comment to my daughter. But it's relating something that I had said earlier. It's relating a command, right? Before I left, I said, "Do the dishes." I come home and I go, "I thought I told you to do the dishes." Well, I'm relating back to the point that a command that I'd said earlier. You see how that works? Okay, another way. I talked about my brother-in-law, the farmer. My brother-in-law had to learn Spanish, okay? It was important to him because he couldn't do business without fluently being able to speak Spanish. So if I had a conversation with him and I said, so tell me, farmer brother-in-law, you learned Spanish to speak to your workers, right? You learned Spanish to speak to your workers. Well, to speak is not talking about a command. He didn't get the command, "You speak." What that sentence is saying, "You learned Spanish to speak to your workers," is the controlling verb learned had an object, Spanish. You learned Spanish. The infinitive there, to speak, is talking about the result of that or why he learned it. It's not a command. The command it wasn't even a command. The controlling verb learned Spanish was what was important. To speak was the result of that learning Spanish. That's different than "I told you to do the dishes." To do the dishes relates back to an original command, do the dishes. Do you see the difference between those two? You see what I'm saying? Okay. So, when we look at these infinitives here in 17 through 24, to put on, to be renewed, and to put off, or to put off, to be renewed, and to put on, are they commands, these infinitives in indirect discourse, like my comment to my daughter, "I told you to do the dishes"? Are they reflecting a command, "Do the dishes"? Or are they like that thing I said to my brother-in-law, "You learned Spanish to speak to your workers"? He learned, controlling verb, object, Spanish, result, speak to the workers. Okay, I disagree with Honer in this situation. I should check Lincoln. I'm not sure if I'm in disagreement with Lincoln or not. Not in the result. Honer and I both agree that these are not commands, that they're statements of fact. They're indicatives. That would be the correct term here. I just disagree why. I believe that there's a controlling verb here. It is not the one that Honer talks about. I believe the controlling verb is in that apodosis of Paul's statement. The controlling verb there is learn, and the object is Christ. Okay, but you did not learn Christ. Learn is the controlling verb. Christ is the object. So that makes these infinitives, like the to speak Spanish, meaning that they just occurred. Boy, I'm getting close to the end of time here, and I've got another good 20 minutes to explain myself. Let's stop now. I hate to stop in mid-thought, but let's stop here. I will pick up next week with, again, the reason why I think those infinitives are indicatives and not commands, and why I think the controlling verb there is learn and not taught, which is what the commentary that I recommended for this class takes as the controlling verb. So let's go ahead and stop there. Yeah, one last question here.
Yeah. You said an infinitive was part noun and part what?
Verb. It's a verbal noun. A participle is a verbal adjective, an infinitive is a verbal noun.
And then what's an indicative?
An indicative is a tense, it's a mood of a verb that just says it's a statement of fact. It's just a, you know, in verbs in Greek, we have verbs, we have a mood of a verb that's the imperative, that's a command. You do this. We have a mood that's probability. It may be that, or it might be this. And then we have the indicative, which is the mood of fact. It is this. So that's, I take these as indicatives, not as imperatives. Okay, I'll see you next week.